Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and this week it's back to school for the charming 80s set British comedy Son of Rambo. We're off to Sweden for the weird comic world of Roy Anderson's You the Living, and we're over into Lebanon for the Oscar-nominated Israeli war drama Beaufort. We start with Son of Rambo, a delightful British comedy about growing up, going to school and making a film to send into that kids' TV institution, Screen Test. Our two little heroes with the big old video camera, Will and Carter, form an unlikely friendship over a long English summer, partly based on recreating stunts from Rambo and partly based on becoming cool when they cast the dashing French exchange student Didier as the lead in their debut film. Son of Rambo is the latest feature from Hammer and Tongs, the production company of Garth Jennings and Nick Goldsmith, previously responsible for the film version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and for those pop videos from Blur, the one with the milk carton and Pulp and Fatboy Slim, among many, many others. Garth's credited here as the writer and director, while Nick has taken the producer credit, but really, as they both readily admit, they do it all together. So Film Weekly undertook the intrepid journey to meet them, on a barge, on the canal, just behind my flat.
If you don't tell me where they are hiding, then I have no choice but to shoot you and your cat. Do you have any last requests?
I was just... Skills.
Three men in a boat. I'm with Nick and Garth. I'm on the Hammer and Tongs barge on the Grand Union Canal.
Welcome aboard, sir.
Thank you very much. This is where you two do all your work. This is where we've seen a hive of activity over the last sort of 6 years.
Yeah, except it's actually not really much of a hive. It's just two of us and a dog just noodling away here, really, quite quietly, getting on with it.
So how does it happen? Is this where you write? This isn't obviously where you make stuff. Or is technology so amazing these days that this is actually where you make stuff?
Yeah,
well,
this is where we're sitting now is where we wrote everything, but also the same room where we edited the film, Son of Rambo. So that room there, that's where the film was cut. And then the boat next door was where all the special effects department and the sound effects department were.
And Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as well?
No, that was before we'd worked out that we could do it all on boats. That was all done in the usual way, in big places with far too many people.
We did the casting here as well.
Oh, yeah, casting.
Casting on the boat.
Yeah,
all the kids came down to the boat.
As much as we can do, we do here. Like this interview.
It's amazing. Yeah. No, it's very nice of you to have it. I only live around the corner, so it works out very, very, very nicely.
High five.
Guys, I wanted to congratulate you on Son of Rambo. Garth, I know we had you on the podcast a couple of weeks ago when I was away talking about the sort of journey of video directors to the big screen. But let's concentrate now on your own journey to the big screen. Let's talk about Son of Rambo as well, because I know you're normally the director, but Nick, you were producer on it as well, so you were just as involved.
I get involved a little bit.
We let him in
silently in the background doing things.
It is a charming story though of two boys growing up with a love of cinema. Is that you two getting together? Is there a germ of your friendship in there?
Well, we actually met later on. We met at art college, so we were 19, 20, I think,
yeah,
when we met.
Yeah,
so it was after those early informative years. And I think we then went through all art college together and carried on through that. But starting out, I mean, I know from my side, when I was young, I wasn't actually making films. We had woods out in the back of our house, you know, and it would be like you'd go out and camp in the back of the woods, you know, make something out of trees and sleep there and freeze completely overnight. Yeah, and catch a cold and come home. But, you know, it was that thing of just hanging out in the woods and doing that sort of stuff.
And having that rich fantasy life.
Yeah, it was just the freedom of sort of like you could just do it and then not come home until the next day and it was all right.
Yeah.
And you'd probably come home a little bit injured. But that's fine. That was all part of it. And so for me, it was very much that. And that's why when Garth went a few years ago, said, look, I've got this idea about, there goes my dog, about how I used to make films when I was a kid, inspired by Rambo, it immediately had a resonance with me. Because even though I wasn't making films, basically doing the same thing.
The thing I liked about the film, and I think it could be seen as almost a criticism of it, but this is certainly in praise of it, is that it does have this air of nostalgia about it, and it's unashamedly romantic,
yes,
about the past.
We love the idea of kids making films, and certainly, you know, that's how I remember my childhood. And there's this ludicrous ambition and this sort of amazing sense of, you know, rather lack of sense of for consequences. You're just not really thinking that far ahead, and it's lovely and it's full of this freedom that you're going to sort of run out of very, very soon as you get older. And I think what we were trying to capture was that, rather than before we had the story, we had the feeling we were after. Mm-hmm. So really everything, including the story, serves that purpose. We were trying to get that lovely feeling of being that age when anything was possible. So that meant we weren't slavish to the reality of it.
So take me back to that original soundboard, mood board kind of collage that you might have stuck to, that original kind of meeting where the seeds of Son of Rambo were born.
Well, it was in Chinatown in a Malaysian restaurant underneath where our office used to be. We were trying to write another script at the time. We hadn't made any films. We were trying to write some space adventure, which wasn't Hitchhikers. It just happened to be another space adventure. And it was going terribly. And
Garth was it was bad.
You had no idea what we were doing. So Garth went, oh, no, how about this? I used to make films when I was a kid. And he told me about Son of Aaron. That, like I said, sparked off my imagination about how it was when I was growing up. And so we just got excited. And it was literally, it was that we went in. We went and got a meeting with Film 4. We didn't really have a mood board or anything like, you know, big ideas or much written down. It was sort of the two of us sitting there getting very excited about what we did when we grew up as kids. And it was sort of infectious, and it sort of snowballed from there.
And I think that you've managed to distill that and keep that for when you're watching the film now, because that's the initial reaction I got when I saw it at the London Film Fest, where everyone's going, oh my God, screen test? Yeah. Oh, I used to watch that. Yeah. I know that's the kind of the purpose of kind of almost lazy TV when you kind of do those list programmes. And we say, oh yeah, Duran, remember them. But this had much more affection for it and much more kind of depth to those memories.
Yeah, I mean, we tried to use those elements of nostalgia to tell the story. We weren't going out there to have fun weren't the 80s hysterical. Mm. And to be honest with you, I'm not really that bothered about reliving the past or certain details as much as just being excited about capturing that time, which sounds a little bit abstract, but really that's the thing that motivated us. It was an amazing time in our lives. It just so happens that when you see someone on a mobile phone in this film, they are holding one of those giant bricks, and people can't help but think, oh, that's a good joke. We never wrote it as a joke. It was just a practical thing. It had to be on the mobile phone.
And people had them. I mean, they did come. I didn't have one, but you know, the older bloke who had one who we read GQ and drove around in that wonderful car. What's the car that you've got in it?
Oh, it's TR7.
No, of course it is.
Again, you just think, well, you need a car of that era, and then you put it in, and people go, the TR7. I mean, we've even had people saying, oh, I'd forgotten those plastic guide dogs for the blind things that were, you put your coin in outside the supermarket.
And Yentl was on at the cinema.
And Yentl on the cinema. But none of these things we really thought of as being, you know, if it were a film about that, it wouldn't be a very good movie. Mm. It would be fun for about 5 minutes. But yeah, it's a sort of lovely sort of, I suppose, the cherry on the cake, as it were. You've got this story about these kids and their film and their friendship, and it's all going up and down and falling apart. But then it's dressed in this glorious garish 80s makeup.
You are going to be the stuntman in the film I'm making for Screen Test.
I am the son of Rambo!
You want to be the son of Rambo?
Promise me you'll put these things out of your mind, William.
I'm not supposed to be friends with you.
What? What's wrong with me?
It's our religion.
If they find out we're friends, then I'll be in the worst trouble ever.
Well!
When we were trying to get the funding for the film, we made a book, like a pitch book, which had bits of the script in it, drawings, plus 80s nostalgia. So we had like a inside page, which was a double page spread of scratch and sniff stickers. And it was lovely finding all the old scratch and sniff stickers, you know, the smelly rubbers that are in the film. Plus we just put references down for 80s. So there was just photos of like 80s icons and things. And making the book was brilliant.
Are you that little boy making a film?
Mm-hmm.
Can we be in it? Please.
I will be star of your movie.
Garth's just gone and got me the book, the kind of mood book that you've put together, we're talking about there, which is full of, you know, lovely images from the movie, but also images of kids having a fag, which is like back of the bike shed stuff.
Yeah, I think that was the thing. I mean, that book was to sort of conjure up the feeling of the movie that people would hopefully invest in. Mm. And we had to make it very clear that we didn't ever want to sort of take off the rough edges of childhood. So they do smoke and they do things that are wrong and they do hurt themselves and they get, you know, they make a mess of things. And I think that was very important for us. That's why you can see there are even photographs from Stand By Me in there, because we love the fact that they would swear and smoke and you know, stay up all night talking about ludicrous things.
There are also photographs, obviously, of Sly Stallone here, the original Rambo.
Yeah.
We're talking about clearance there with pop music. How were the makers of Rambo about you having you, even the name Rambo? I know you've spelled it differently in the title. Yeah.
And initially, the clearances were... It didn't seem to be a problem initially, because it was a film clip licensing deal where we found out who owned them, which was Studio Canal. Called them up and they said, yep, no, that's fine. How much time do you need of each one? And we were like, this much and this much. And it all seemed very straightforward. But as time went on, things changed slightly in the sense of it was felt that the film relied more on the clips, in the sense of we couldn't use clips from any other film. It had to be Rambo. So thus it wasn't a straight clip licensing deal. Mm. It went to something else. So then it just became a longer negotiation.
Mm.
But it wasn't technically difficult. I mean, once we found out who owned the clips, that was fine. And then it's a matter of you have to get permission from the actors who are in the clips. Garth wrote a letter to Stallone.
Yeah, it's nice to sit down and write, Dear Mr. Stallone, it's a good day. Especially as that's what kicked you off in the first place. And that was one of the nice things about hearing that he liked the film.
He's seen it now.
He's seen it and loved it and given us lots of praise. And even at junkets as well, I keep meeting interviewers who say, I was talking to him about his film and I told him about yours and he was singing your praises. So it's like, oh, right, thank you, Stallone. That's nice.
That's extraordinary. You might be in for Rambo 6.
I'm up for that. I mean, there's room for improvement, I would say. Let's try it out, yeah.
Now, we did mention memoirs before. You've mentioned Stand By Me, which you've just shown me in the mood. But were there other childhood cinematic memoirs that came to mind?
Midnight Cowboy was quite a strong influence when we were writing the script.
Yeah.
Which is a weird one for this film.
Yeah, I mean, there's two people in it. But...
There's two people in it.
How do you link male prostitution with a coming-of-age story?
But we kept on coming back to just that relationship between Ratso and Joe Buck. You know, it being a love story. Mm. You know, not in a sexual manner, but it was a love story. And the unlikely pairing of those two. And so we'd often talk about that film when we were working on scenes with Son of Rambo. To the extent where there's a scene in the sick form common room in the film, which is like our version of a hedonistic sort of world. And it's sort of loosely based on the scene in Midnight Cowboy when they go to some party in New York and it's all, you know, drug-fueled and Ratso goes falling down the stairs.
But it is that forbidden world, isn't it? I mean, when you were a fourth former, you couldn't get into the sixth form common room. I mean, unless you were either summoned there like on some special mission, in which it'd be a great adventure, or it was the school holidays and you'd broken in and you weren't really allowed in.
Well, you're revealing more about yourself now, your little cat burglary days, creeping in to get the stuff from the naffy. When I got to the sixth form common room, I don't know about you if you stayed on for your sixth form, but the sixth form was rubbish at my school. Absolutely, it was the most boring letdown.
A dartboard and a kettle.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we had some crisps. And someone had painted like pictures from, you know, tried to copy album artwork on the walls. And prior to that, I'd thought, oh, you know, the girls would come in and out of that forbidden door with makeup on. And you think, what goes on? And you could hear music. And these are no school uniform. All the things that you were, you know, not allowed to do. So Son of Rambo has a scene that is very much based on how we imagine it being rather than the crushing disappointment of what it was really like. Yeah,
you've also got, I mean, I think what forms one of the backbone of one of the storylines is the French exchange, which I've never seen in a British film before, not even mentioned, and yet it was a huge part of everyone's life. I mean, you were either sort of cast out into Siberia because you didn't go on the French exchange, and like, how did you get away with it and still you could speak a bit of French? You know, if you didn't do this French exchange, you would never speak French, you would never pass your O-levels.
Yeah.
And you had to have the little blighters back to your house.
Yeah,
I did it one way, Frederick, so that was seen as the real coward's way out, but there was no way I was wasting 2 weeks of my summer having a frog back at my house.
No frogs at your house.
No frogs at my house.
I like the fact that you're not racist as well. That's terrific.
I'm using the language then, obviously now.
Yeah, you're just, I see, you're getting into the spirit of the whole 80s nostalgia. You wouldn't say that now, would you?
Never.
No, we laugh at
Grenouille.
Monsieur. No, the French exchange thing just was one of the early parts of the idea. I mean, we had it even before we had the story, we had this sort of feeling we're after, these sort of characters, these events, and the French exchange students. In fact, writing those scenes, we were talking about this the other day, writing French exchange stuff
was very distracting because you would get so carried away. Mm. Because at that time, they appeared to be so exotic, much more interesting than any of us. They didn't wear school uniform. The boys already had moustaches when we could only dream of having that kind of fluff on our faces. And, you know, they brought fireworks and Hollywood chewing gum and all these things. We thought, wow, you know, the girls were all kind of interesting. And it genuinely was great, you know, even though we'd, you know, people would resent going or you'd get lumbered with some rubbish one. There were always a few that made up for it. And the main French exchange kid in our film, Didier Revol, is a kind of amalgamation of almost everyone we've ever spoken to's French exchange experience. That's why he's slightly larger than life, I think you'd agree. But yeah, it's a goldmine for just comedy and just ridiculous outfits.
Like all the best comic ideas, it is a wonder no one's ever done it before. But I can't even remember an episode of Grange Hill or anything. I don't think they did French Exchange in Grange Hill.
Probably didn't. No, it's too rough.
Yeah.
They'd imagine. Susan Tully would have decked them.
we did talk about on set, because everyone loved the French Exchange thing so much. We did talk about, you know, we were joking, but we'll make a sequel where Duncan, who's the English kid who has Didier as his French exchange, goes to France. Mm. And it's like a Jean de Florette, where Duncan saves the vineyard or something.
With his cheeky, chappy ways, you know. That's what this little vineyard needs to restore to its former glory. I think there's a sequel there, I'm sure. We're sort of pitching it on your podcast. I hope you don't mind that. If anyone wants to buy into that.
Then, I think we could get you £25. Certainly.
That's nice.
For a mood book.
Mood book, let's do it.
Well, I do wish you the best of luck with the film. I am surprised, and I don't mean this in a bad way, that it's going so big, as they say in the interview, across like 300 screens. I mean,
250 screens.
Just the 250.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was a lovely film. I thought it was a little kind of indie film that people would kind of grow to like, and people would sort of say, have you seen the haters and all that? But now everyone's talking about it.
Well, this is it. It's sort of one of those weird things where we don't govern that. We can't decide these things, but it's just had a great response. Whenever we've played it, people have really enjoyed it. Now, we don't have any stars in it. Eric Sykes, as far as we're concerned, is a big star, but he's not a poster boy anymore. No. You know, even Eric would agree to that. It's really just the film itself has just had such a big, warm reaction, and people have been so positive about it that I think that's why the distributors have decided to capitalise on that and just give it a shot. Why not? I mean, it's worth it.
Yeah, it certainly is. Guys, thank you very much for coming on to Film Week. Congratulations on Son of Rambo. We do wish you the best of luck with it, and I might go and go on a French exchange now. It's about time.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks very much indeed.
Garth Jennings and Nick Goldsmith there, and Son of Rambo is out nationwide from next week, April the 4th. Out this week is one of the most original films of the year. Indeed, unless you've seen his Cannes Prize winner Songs from the Second Floor from 2000, I'll bet Roy Anderson's You, the Living is unlike anything you've seen on the big screen before. His films are more like surreal sketch shows, series of loosely connected scenes that sometimes contain connected characters. In You, the Living, he patches together 50 or so tableaux that construct a jigsaw of modern life in all its weirdness, sadness, humour and love. Windows and frames play a huge part in Anderson's work. His camera rarely moves, rather the characters walk in and out of its shot. Anderson sort of suggests a dramatic infinity, a world of stories, both comic and tragic, that we can never fully know or comprehend. It's as if we, the audience, are eavesdropping on You, the Living. So, I dropped in on Roy Anderson in Sweden. Roy, congratulations on your film, You, the Living. What is it in Swedish? Du Levande?
Yes, Du Levande.
Du Levande. We like to pronounce these things correctly here at Film.
Yes.
I mean, I loved it when I saw it in Cannes, and I loved it when I saw it again. It seems to me a film that you can see many times because there are so many different scenes and so many different stories in there. And in fact, it suggests a million stories outside of the film itself. Is that what your intention was?
Yes, that's true. That's why I left so-called linear story, because I wanted to spread out all the stuff about the human being and his conditions to many people, not only to a couple.
Yes, that's right, because, I mean, you get the feeling that there are millions of other stories happening outside of the door frames, outside of the window frames. You can't tell every story, Roy.
No.
but you managed to tell quite a few, I suppose, and that's the joy of it. It's like a puzzle of life you've assembled.
Yeah, But that's true. That's my intention also. So you got it perfectly.
All right. Well, we can finish the interview then. What happens in your stories? You've called trivialism that your approach to it. Well, what, just explain to me the philosophy behind trivialism.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Beckett, Waiting for Godot especially, and the other one, the Ender. Or
Endgame,
something.
We call
it. Endgame, yes. And this, especially Waiting for Godot, people are talking nonsense for 2-3 hours, and at the same time you feel that they are talking of very important things. So I really like the banal dialogue or trivial dialogue.
Yes, in a way, your characters suggest so much more. Sometimes I think when the scene ends in your films, I think, oh, damn, they were just about to get really interesting, or something brilliant was just about to happen. There's always something sort of agonising about the way you frame your characters and give them their little 5 minutes of life.
Yeah, as I see it, so nowadays, and not only nowadays, all the time, the human beings, as we are confused and lost also, and we have a fantastic tool to survive and to make it easier for us, namely humor. The humor is a fantastic mean, fantastic tool to stand the situation, and in the bottom there is of course sadness and sorrow, some feeling of insufficientness that you can survive by help of humor. I mean, humor and comics, it's always about failures and insufficientness, as I see it.
Yes, I think you're right. And I mean, what's very interesting to me is recently on YouTube, we've been able to see some of your commercials, which
yes.
Here in the British audience, we don't get to see so many. And they are there on YouTube. I know you do a lot of commercials and spent many years doing them. Did you find them artistically satisfying? Simply because you apply the same aesthetic or the same technique as you almost do to your stories on the films?
Yeah. I mean, I make the commercials with the same seriousness as make features. Yes, I'm very, very careful about making commercials also.
You don't have any film snobbery about commercials?
No. And I also want to tell about Mr. Nobody or Mrs. Nobody. I mean, I feel myself to be in a tradition that started with, for example, Chaplin and Dan Laurel and Oliver Hardy.
Yes.
They are my favourites. They want to be perfect, but they fail always.
And do you think your characters fail? There seems to be some of them have a success, or at least or at least fulfil their dreams sometimes.
In the dreams they succeed, yes, but in reality, that is it's harder.
It is, and there's a wonderful scene in your film, one of the most beautiful I've seen in film this year, where the dream starts and the man's playing his guitar and the world starts moving by.
Yeah.
I don't know technically how you did that. Is it two different frames of film?
No. It's not made by computer. We built it up in a huge set, in a huge studio.
Wow, so it's just like a train set moving.
Yes, and outside we built up that late landscape, and the scale in the beginning, scale 1 to 50, at the end 1 to 1, when they reach the station.
Yes. Wow. So how many people did you have in there?
Oh, my God. I think we were 30 or 40 persons that built it. And on the station there were some hundreds.
Wow! I mean, it is spectacular, and I think it worked. And it, you know, I was questioning how you did it, and I suppose that that's the kind of texture that you were going for. You couldn't really do it without with computers, could you? The same way.
My previous movie, Songs from the Second Floor.
Yes, I loved that.
I tried to use computer, but it was not as good quality as analog.
Yeah.
Yes, I prefer to make it in reality this time also. But in future, maybe when the technique will be better, I will change to computer.
And you can see You the Living in selected cinemas this week. And if you're in London, do pop into the Renoir on Friday night or the Curzon Soho on Saturday night for special screenings accompanied by some of Roy Anderson's commercials and some Swedish snacks and drinks. Tell them we sent you, and there's an extra shot of vodka in it for you. The absurdity, not of life, but of war, is at the heart of Beaufort, an Oscar-nominated drama from Israel also released in the UK this week. Directed by Joseph Sedar, it focuses on a troop of young soldiers at the infamous Beaufort outpost in Lebanon just before the Israeli withdrawal in 2000 from this dangerous, wind-blasted mountain. Joseph himself spent 9 months serving in the Israeli army in the Lebanon as a teenager, and I called him to ask about his very different experience with this Beaufort. What was more important to you, Joseph? Was it capturing a feel of a movie or getting a message across with this movie, or could you never separate the two?
It's hard to separate. It's hard to put your finger on what it is exactly that you're putting on screen. I mean, you create an atmosphere that's constructed of so many different little elements, the cast, the set, even the people who are working behind the camera. They all come together to some kind of atmosphere that ends up on screen. And I think with this film, a lot of what an audience gets is the seriousness and the devotion that everyone involved had in making this film. We were dealing with a subject that was very, very close to us, and we knew we had to do something that will have an impact. And somehow that seriousness ended up on screen.
Now, you say it was something very close to you, and I know because I've spoken to some Israeli friends of mine of a certain age for whom the name Beaufort has a real kind of ring to it, has a real fear for it. If you were growing up at a certain time in Israel and you heard the name Beaufort, you knew you were being sent to perhaps the most dangerous place you could be sent to in the Israeli army. People grew up in fear of this name. Is that right?
That's correct, and this is true for only my generation. I think younger people in Israel knew of Beaufort just vaguely. But when I was growing up, Beaufort was not only a scary and dangerous place, but it was also very symbolic, and there was something mythological about it.
Symbolic of what?
It was symbolic of Israeli control, Israeli power. I mean, the highest mountain in southern Lebanon, and the battle there, at least the way I first heard of the battle, was portrayed as this heroic, romantic battle. So actually being on Beaufort, being sent to Beaufort, wasn't only scary, it also felt a little bit like a privilege to be sent to such an historically significant place.
Well, that's right. That's why I liked the movie. In a way, you would think it might be, as you say, a symbol of some patriotism, some heroism in the end. But in the fact, it becomes kind of the opposite. It's a symbol for the futile nature of war, the kind of waste of life, and for almost a kind of an examination of the kind of mess of Israeli politics.
I'll agree with what you just said. even though, I mean, you worked so hard on putting a story together so that it doesn't have one clear-cut message.
Of course, no, there are heroes in it too, absolutely.
Something of what you said is true for the film and I think true for reality, but it's probably a little bit more complicated than just that.
Anything about Israel always is, and I'm wondering why I asked at the beginning of the interview about the Oscar reception for it and the international reception to it, how it was felt in Israel. Has it been seen as unpatriotic in Israel? Because you have that wonderful scene of the father on the TV interview, and it's an extremely moving scene when he's criticising himself for not educating his son enough to desert the army or to at least refuse to go to there, which is an extraordinary thing.
The scene you mentioned is a scene that originated in something my father told me. The word patriotism somehow sounds sour in some context, but in other contexts it's admirable. I'm not sure a movie is a good test for anyone's patriotism. It deals with caring about the place where you live, and caring doesn't necessarily mean accepting everything or embracing everything that your country stands for. You can care for a place and have a lot of criticism of it.
Joseph Sedar there, speaking from Tel Aviv. Also out this week are two American comedies. 27 Dresses stars Katherine Heigl, who was so winning in Knocked Up last year, but who now forsakes being pregnant for being an eternal bridesmaid. She's Jane, a New Yorker in love with her boss, Ed Burns, and with a closet full of 27 dresses she's worn over the years to friends' weddings, which she's also helped organise. Her role is happy until her younger sister walks in, steals her boss's heart, and asks her to organise the wedding. It's one step too far for Jane, especially as her favourite New York wedding reporter is writing a special column on the nuptials.
So you went by the flower shop.
Yep.
And ordered the favors.
Uh-huh.
What about the invitation mock-ups?
Done.
This is so much fun. Did I tell you I asked Julie to be one of the bridesmaids?
Who?
Cousin Julie, second cousin, twice removed.
What about Mimi? Cousin Mimi?
Oh, no way. She's so pregnant. It'll just throw off the aesthetics. I'm sorry. I know you don't love Julie.
What's not to love about a woman who asked me if I chaired the itty-bitty committee all through my teen years?
Just don't listen to her. I mean, your boobs came in eventually. They just missed high school. Now, as for the third bridesmaid, I want you to ask your friend. You know that really rude one?
Casey?
Yeah.
My Casey.
Yeah, yeah. She's really pretty. She can pull off a strapless. You know, I don't have that many girlfriends. For some reason, girls just don't like me. I don't know why.
27 Dresses is fluff, but it's certainly not unbearable, largely due to the charm of Katherine Heigl as a comic performer. She elicits our sympathies with great skill, never forcing the laughs with eye-popping mugging, nor trying to bend the script into jokey readings that just aren't there. Her gusto and glimpses of vulnerability make this a girly rom-com any man can just about get through with pride intact. Heigl connects to the week's other comedy through her work on Knocked Up. That was last summer's surprise hit comedy from the flavour-of-the-moment producer Judd Apatow, who now follows hits such as Superbad and The 40-Year-Old Virgin with Drillbit Taylor. It's another geek comedy, repeating the Thin Geek, Fat Geek, Total Geek trio from Superbad, as three boys hire a private bodyguard to protect themselves from the high school bully. The guard happens to be Owen Wilson, a low-life con artist living rough on Venice Beach, but who convinces the boys he's ex-army and convinces the school staff he's a stand-in supply teacher.
You know what this is? It's a wing, and you're under it. All three of you, right there.
This is very disturbing.
Using my expertise at stealth and covert ops, I'll infiltrate the school.
Oh! Teacher's lounge. It's right over there. What do you teach?
English.
My native tongue.
Wilson peddles his butterscotch charms and comes up with another likeable comic performance, more than matched by the youngsters. The film does have its fair share of giggles and smart lines. I teach kung fu and Mexican judo, as in, you don't know what you'll let yourself in for, sucker. I thought that was one of the best, and although it doesn't really make complete logical sense as a fully polished comedy, it's got enough rough-edged family appeal to get by. So that's it for this week's show. My thanks to Garth Jennings and Nick Goldsmith for letting us on their barge, and to all our guests this week. Film Weekly was produced by Paul Noble. I'm Jason Solomons, and until next time, we wish you all very happy viewing.